Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
We have both been suffering from a cold, so if on occasion you hear a hiccup, a whatever sound emerging from us, that's because we're still feeling the after effects. But we definitely wanted to do this radio show today on this team because tomorrow is December 8th. And when you're being faced between, if you're from Europe, Sinterklaas, or the European continental version of Santa Claus, which happens on December the 6th, and in the run-up to Christmas, December 8th might not be a very important day. But it definitely was once, and still is, for the Catholics, and we will go into that as well. But if people have been reading the latest issue of Atlantis Rising, or have gone to my website, philipcoppens.com, they will see that on Friday, an article was uploaded there with very specific references to December the 8th. And it's a story which Kathleen immersed me in almost from the very first time Kathleen and I spoke. And it's one of these stories which one comment on my Facebook page actually said sounded outlandish. Not imaginary, not impossible, just so incredible, so outlandish, because it brings so many things together. Okay, so let's start to discuss what this story actually is all about. And this story is about probably the most interesting aspect of Los Angeles, which nobody's aware of, and which, whenever I think about it, comes straight out of like a Man in Black with Will Smith kind of screenwriting, because it has all of those ingredients. Again, it's outlandish. Whenever people have heard about this story, and we have been sitting around a dinner conversation table with the likes of Giorgio and David Childress, they are intrigued, they are convinced, but at the same time, they are once again confronted with the fact that it is so incredible. And I think part of the incredible nature of the story is that it's completely unknown. Mm-hmm. So, Kathleen, as you're the expert on this, introduce us to the mystery that is the Hollywood Cross.
Well, you know, it is an outlandish story. And, you know, back to our February conversation where we had a number of the Ancient Aliens crew around us. These are guys who really understand this world, and even they were skeptical. I mean, they put me through a fair grilling, you know, over the information. And I want to emphasize, as I tell this story, that this is the way the story was revealed to me and how it has been sort of uncovered through my, since 1993, really, for me, that I first became aware of this story. And in some ways longer, because I'm a third generation native of the Hollywood area. My grandmother graduated from Hollywood High School in the 20s. So, you know, I'm very familiar with the area. I've had some interesting exposures to the history of Hollywood, which is so much different than people who are not natives have any idea. You know, that's one of the things I want to talk about. LA gets such a bad rap is having no history and having no culture. And it's absolutely not true. In fact, the people who give LA a bad rap for the most part are not people who are from LA. The city itself, and you're going to talk about it too, because you know a lot about the really early fascinating Native American history, of this region. But there is so much power here. And when you come here and you spend time here, especially if you're able to do it with those of us, who grew up in it, who had parents and grandparents who can tell stories, of the land itself, you will view Los Angeles in a completely different way than it's portrayed in, you know, the slicker TV series of the 20th and the 21st century. I mean, you have seen that in the time that you have been here, coming here from Europe and really seeing Los Angeles in depth over the last year and a half.
Yes, actually, real people live in Hollywood.
Yes, real people live in Hollywood. Really amazing people live in Hollywood. You know, and there is, you know, this extraordinary spiritual undercurrent. And I'm not talking about trendy, new agey kind of things. That's not what I'm talking about. There is a depth to this city when you scratch the surface. I mean, the original name of this city is not just Los Angeles, the Angels. It is Our Lady Queen of the Angels. That's the name of this place. So it's had this profound, sacred, feminine, spiritual, you know, essence to it for a very, very long time.
And I think it's something kind of like, you know, it's not as that, but I think one person who actually extremely does capture that mood that Los Angeles has another quality to it, which you can kind of see specifically in the valley, is actually City of Angels, where that magical aspect is more incorporated, that actually there is more to Los Angeles than just what everybody always gets to hear.
Plug for City of Angels, directed by the great Brad Silberling. Fantastic movie, wonderful director, amazing man.
So, and this story is again set in Hollywood, and Hollywood is very much, you know, a very hilly, woody kind of area, at least in origin it was, no doubt extremely holly. And the question is also, you know, straight away, does the name refer to a Hollywood? Was there something holy about it? And I think that's where really the story begins, isn't it? Because there's lots of giveaways that the specific area of Hollywood, before we're going to put it in the context of the Native Americans of the region, might have had a very specifically sacred nature to it.
Well, if you have ever even been to Los Angeles as a tourist, for example, you've probably driven that strip or been driven on that strip between Universal Studios and Hollywood Boulevard, where you come around through the Hollywood Hills. And on one side, you have the Hollywood Bowl. You pass Universal Studios, and you've got the Hollywood Bowl that comes up on your right. And on the left side, there is a hill, which can be seen from most of Hollywood. And on the top of the hill is a white cross. And this white cross is illuminated. And it's one of the landmarks in Hollywood and has been there for a very long time. And I remember, you know, always wondering, gosh, what is that cross on that hill? And who owns that? And who pays for that illumination of that? It's because it's large. It's you know, it's quite a big monument. But I realized that there was something going on, you know, much later in my life. But I will say, to back up, you know, my grandmother used to tell me the legends around Hollywood. My mother used to talk to me about going to downtown Los Angeles with her grandmother on the streetcar to meet in the back rooms with the Chinese herbalists who imported herbs from Asia. There was a lot of witchy stuff going on. When I was a kid, my mother came from a pagan environment, so not a traditional upbringing, but we used to go down to Long Beach in San Pedro, where there was this occult shop, which is what it was called back then, you know, with these crone-ish women who had little powdered things in the back room. There is a lot of that sort of in-the-closet occultism going on in Hollywood when I was a child in the 60s. But when you start looking around the hill, what you find is clues to the idea that something's been happening in Hollywood for a long time. There are a lot of places that are referred to as pilgrimage sites. For example, the road that leads up behind the cross on the hill is called Pilgrimage Place. The bridge that crosses from the Hollywood Bowl over the freeway to the John Anson Ford Theater is called the Pilgrimage Bridge. Now, it was always called that for as long as I can remember as a child, but it's only recently in the last few years that the city of Hollywood has put up official signs that call it the Pilgrimage Bridge. So they're just now sort of stepping into this heritage. I remember when I first started investigating the story in the 90s, calling the city of Hollywood and trying to get information on all these pilgrimage places, and no one could tell me anything. It really took a lot of digging for me to get anywhere on this story, because I wanted to know, what's the pilgrimage? Why are people going to this hill on a pilgrimage? Why is this bridge called the Pilgrimage Bridge? And I was told that, you know, the origins of those stories were lost, basically, that no one really knew what it was. It might have had something to do with the original Indians. There's a street that runs around that area called Cahuenga, which in the Indian dialect means place of the hill. So that's another thing that leads us to what's going on with this hill. Clearly, this hill, which has all kinds of pilgrimage ideas around it, has been important for a long time in this city, and nobody could tell me why.
Yes, and when you drive around that immediate area, there's definitely on the hills, not on the what I will call the hillside of the freeway, but on the other side, there are definitely hills which have shown signs of terracing, clear signs of terracing. Nothing to do with house construction. Might have been recently to do with if somebody tried to do a gigantic vineyard or some kind of preparation for house building 100 years ago. But from immediate kind of impressions, if you want, it could be much older as well. It could be centuries old. It could be even older. That's the problem with terracing. Once it looks old, and you need to really do some archaeological research to give a specific date. So the fact that a lot of these hills have some kind of terracing to them to make them look into platforms also suggests that at some point in the past, some Indians might have been doing certain things within a sacred landscape there. And obviously, because everywhere in the Western world, if not the entire world, when you do not know this is happening, or even but on purpose, by Catholics when they were so-called civilizing the area, some of the sacred places were completely taken over and are now lost forever, hidden underneath streets or buildings. And so the only visible thing which we have, and it's a very impressive sight, specifically at night when you see almost this cross hanging in the middle of the air, so to speak, when you approach it, and then you realize it actually sits on a hill, hanging over or on top of this hill. And when he started doing research into it, you found that actually, from a survey point of view, that specific hill is very interesting and unique as well.
It is very interesting and unique as well, and it is the only lot of property anywhere in the city of Los Angeles, possibly in the county of Los Angeles, that is carved out as a perfect circle. There is no such thing as a circular lot in Los Angeles. So, for example, when you look on the survey maps of how property is broken down in Los Angeles, the hill itself is its own space, which belongs to the city of Los Angeles, but the top piece surrounding the cross is a perfect circle that is identified as a separate piece of property that is privately owned. And it has been very specifically created as a circular piece of property with very specific dimensions. Whoever created this piece of land carved it out, and created this in a very specific way. My understanding is that it happened probably sometime in the 30s. There's some issues with when the survey maps were filed in Los Angeles. But in talking to some experts who know the area, they said they believe this happened sometime in the 20s or the 30s, most likely the 30s. How it originally happened, nobody knows. How it was allowed, nobody knows, because it is entirely outside of all the regulations for surveys. But somebody went to a lot of effort to make this a very specific private lot. At this moment, it is currently privately owned by a church. It was an heiress actually left it to a church in a suburb of Los Angeles, who was responsible, by the way, for the electricity and the upkeep of the cross. But the other thing that's interesting about it is there are no easements. In other words, there's no way to access the property. There are no roads that go up there. It's a very strange piece of property to own unless you have a very specific reason for owning it. And maybe that reason is just the illumination of the cross, or maybe that reason is something else. And the outlandish story to which we refer from the beginning of the show is it is what some people believe actually has happened with this property.
Because when we go slightly forward in time, about 3 decades, 4 decades actually, from the 1930s to New Year's Day, at the I think 1970 or 1971, when a very famous astrology writer, Linda Goodman, is present in LA, and she has a most extraordinary encounter which will change her life and which she has written about in a book, which you will detail and explain in detail within seconds. All of a sudden, the cross takes on a very specific significance. It is no longer seen as just something which people drive past, but for this very famous astrologer, Linda Goodman, it becomes a lifetime obsession And potentially, if we ever are able to find that, potentially the greatest archaeological discovery in the known universe.
I truly believe it will eventually be one of the greatest archaeological discoveries ever. And that's why I welcome the skeptics and I welcome people calling it outlandish, because I can't wait for the day that we prove that the outlandish can be true. And my faith in Linda is such that that we will prove this for her. Linda Goodman was an extraordinary woman. If you're not familiar with her work, she was the astrologer who really brought astrology to the masses. With her book, Linda Goodman's Sun Signs, which sold over 100 million copies worldwide. The book that we talk about, and my personal favorite Linda Goodman book, which I recommend to everyone, and I have given out in the, 10s to 20s, 30s, in terms of copies to friends over the years, is Linda Goodman's Star Signs. Linda Goodman's Star Signs is a fantastic personal journey book about her journey through the magical. That's filled with all kinds of legends and stories and information on numerology and astrology and her points of view and the things that she, encountered along the way. And it's just a treasure trove of information, and it is so much fun to read. So run out and pick that up if you've never read Linda Goodman's Star Signs. My mother gave me a copy of Linda Goodman's Sun Signs when I was a child. I was 10 or 11. Maybe 12 at the oldest when I first read Linda Goodman's Sun Signs, sorry, her astrology book, and fell in love with everything that she had written. I loved her writing style. I wanted to be an astrologer. So she'd been a hero of mine for a very, very long time. Cut to 1992, 1993. I was working for the Walt Disney Company. I was working in the studios. I was also doing some freelance writing. A very, very dear friend of mine was working for a major Hollywood talent agency. This particular friend, I had given her all of Linda Goodman's books as a birthday gift. So she was familiar with Linda and she had devoured the books as well. So imagine my surprise one day when she called me at work and said, "You are never going to believe who I just talked to, who just called the agency." And I said, "Who?" She said, "Linda Goodman." And I said, "What? You're kidding." And the quick version of the story is this. Linda had been through some very traumatic events in her life, in terms of her spirituality, but also in terms of her family. Her 19-year-old daughter, Sally, had disappeared mysteriously under some extraordinary circumstances. Reports were that Sally had killed herself. Linda never believed that the body found was her daughter. And Linda spent the majority of the rest of her life trying to find Sally, trying to prove that Sally was alive, and trying to prove that Sally had been the victim of foul play in what was a very extraordinary conspiracy story. This, of course, losing your child is the most devastating thing that can happen to anyone. And Linda devoted most of her life to trying to find Sally. And a lot of people were very patronizing with her. Oh, mother's grief. Of course, she doesn't want to believe that her child is dead. And of course, she doesn't want to believe that her child killed herself. But Linda was one of the most doggedly determined women in the history of the world. And her research skills were extraordinary. She had great instincts and she never gave up. And she had amassed this extraordinary information about this conspiracy that she believed that Sally had stumbled into. And no one would take her seriously. No one would listen to her. The authorities wouldn't listen to her. So she decided back in the early 90s that the one person in the world who it would be great for her to talk to, who might really understand what she was trying to explain, and that all conspiracies are not just theories, was director Oliver Stone. She was a big fan of his work. She loved his fearlessness. She loved his fascination with digging into conspiracy. And she wanted to present her story of searching for Sally to him. And she was, of course, hoping he would make a movie about her life and her search for Sally. And that's how I got pulled into this story. My friend who had answered the phone happened to work for the agency that represented Oliver Stone, and she ended up taking Linda's call. And she ended up befriending Linda in this way and suggested to Linda that they bring me in to write the original synopsis, the treatment, to interview Linda, get all the information together. Linda, of course, was extremely emotionally attached to this story. It was recommended that she bring in someone who could sort of sort through it and present it in such a way that would be, you know, accessible for the agency and for Oliver Stone. And that is how I first got involved. Linda Goodman, being Linda Goodman, would not work with me unless she could do my astrological chart. So she did, and I was an Aries, she was an Aries, we had all kinds of things in common. But there were certain things in my chart that made Linda very interested and very excited, and one of them was that I was born in Hollywood. And ultimately, this led to a five-hour telephone conversation that I had with Linda when she was living in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel about this white cross on the hill. The story that Linda Goodman told me that night has haunted me ever since and will until the day I die. Linda Goodman told me she stayed in this particular suite in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel because it was in perfect alignment with this white cross on the hill. And she needed to be in the energy of that cross, and she needed to see it, and that she was doing very special investigations. She could only tell me this because she only told her closest immediate friends, but after having done my chart and seeing that I was connected to her astrologically, but also that I was a Hollywood-born girl, she felt that I needed to know this information. This led to another conversation about, I'll come back to that because I don't want to spoil the story. Linda told me that she believed with all of her heart that there was a pyramid, a subterranean pyramid underneath that hill. Now that in itself is outlandish enough, but not impossible given what we've seen that's been discovered around the world. But what Linda Goodman told me was what was specifically important about this pyramid is she believed and hoped to prove that the 14th piece of the god Osiris was buried in a sarcophagus in this pyramid under the hill, therefore making this a pilgrimage place for however many thousands of years. And I want to turn this over to you to talk about the legend of Isis and Osiris in case people listening are not familiar with this idea of there being 14 pieces of Osiris.
Well, I mean, first of all, Osiris, you know, the story of Osiris is that Osiris was a god. He was the ruler of ancient Egypt. According to Manetho, he was real in the sense that he was physically present at some point in the past on this earth. And he ruled Egypt and was considered to be one of the greatest rulers. He was a god. He was married to his sister, but also spiritual other half, twin soul Isis, who, you know, in Roman times specifically would become together the best known Egyptian deities. Osiris is also extremely well known for being what is quite often been described as the prototype Jesus, because what happens to Osiris is very much in parallel with what happens to Jesus the Last Supper onwards. What happens to Osiris is this, that his brother, Seth, and his other sister, Nephthys, basically conspire to kill him. And this happens by Seth inviting him to a supper, to a dinner party, where he is basically locked up in a chest and as such killed. There are various stories afterwards as to what specifically happened. A very popular one, though not necessarily the most original one, says that the chest is thrown into the River Nile. The chest ends up in Libya, grows into a tree, and is then found later by Horus or by another hero who goes on from there. The most popular version, and the one which the Egyptians believed most widely, is that the Egyptians were very much into keeping the body whole. If every part of the body was there, and specifically if the body was in one piece, It was believed that definitely the soul could be contacted, if not far more interesting things could be done with spirit and essence, if not the body itself. The reason why decapitation in many religions became so important was because it was believed that when a person was decapitated, they could not possess you, or that there could be certain things not happening to you, that soul was gotten rid of, if you want, for at least a good number of years, if not longer. So what Set devises and what the Egyptians believed happened to Osiris was that his body was cut into, and there are two versions, 14 or 16 pieces, but again, the most widely believed version is 14. And it is said that the 14 pieces of Osiris were cast or buried in various places along the River Nile, i.e. Egypt, and hopefully this will be the end of Osiris, and Seth can do as he pleases. And he probably assumes that Isis will weep for a very long period of time, we'll probably try to hit him in the face, but that's about it. Well, guess what? Love conquers all. So Isis sets about trying to find all the 14 pieces, and she gets 13 of them, except the 14th, which is his penis. His phallus has been thrown into the River Nile, where fish have eaten it. Which is, by the way, the reason why ancient Egyptian priests did not eat fish. Because the fish had basically eaten a holy object, and they wanted to not basically have anything to do with that as their food. So Isis knows that she has a non-complete body of Osiris to work with. And so she finds out her magic, and she realizes that if she crafts a phallus from wood, she is still able to perform her magic. Because the object is that even though Osiris can no longer be hers, she somehow, with all the power at her disposal, is able to create magically an offspring from her deceased husband. So she makes a phallus out of wood, and with rituals, she is able to conceive Horus, the divine child, which obviously shares many parallels with what the Catholic Church would make Jesus into as well later on. So, for the ancient Egyptians, and again, as Egypt became older, Osiris and Isis' roles more prominently became singled out as being what Egypt really stood for. But they are the greatest love story. They were twin souls who were destined to be together, and through the forces of chaos were not only separated, but one of them was brutally murdered, but which also showed and underlined to everybody living in Egypt that love conquered all. And their story was told, portrayed, and the annual flooding of the Nile was also incorporated with Isis giving birth to this divine offspring of Horus. And so that, in a nutshell, is the story of Osiris and Isis, and the belief that the 14th piece of Osiris was lost forever.
But was it lost forever becomes the question. I just want to backtrack a little bit on the story. One of the things that I love about this story of Isis and Osiris, I love it for so many reasons. And unfortunately and sadly, there's really not a lot of great literature out there. I've spent a lot of my life looking for great Isis and Osiris literature and have found really not so much. And eventually would like to, create that as a project where I put together all of the Isis and Osiris material that I've collected over the years. Jonathan Cott wrote quite a beautiful book some years ago called Isis and Osiris. I don't know if it's in print anymore, but I definitely recommend it if anyone wants to go out and search for it. But this idea that Isis goes and collects the pieces of her beloved so that she can resurrect him, because certainly in ancient Egypt, you needed your body to go into the afterlife, didn't you? So this was her gift to him. She wanted to restore him so that he would have his body in the afterlife. And so she goes and collects his pieces And one of the things that I love about this is she collects his members, and therefore she remembers him. So this idea of remembering Osiris is literal, as well as figurative, and I've always thought that was extremely beautiful. And her extraordinary determination that nothing was going to stop her from saving and resurrecting her beloved, I've always thought was extraordinary. And I think that there's some amazing metaphors about love conquering all here. I think the other thing is that the murder of Osiris represents the fall of man. You know, this is the other thing metaphorically. The idea is that when Isis and Osiris reigned together as equals, as twins, twin divine energies, male and female energy, in this perfect union of love and light, that there was this one brief shining moment on Earth where everything, it was really Eden on Earth. Everything was really divine. And so the jealousy of Seth, the darkness that creeps in, that causes him to murder his brother and destroy paradise, destroy Eden, destroy Atlantis, just whatever, any way you want to look at it, it really is the metaphor for where it all goes wrong, where the darkness seeps in and overshadows the light. So it's such an important story for so many reasons. So this idea of finding the 14th piece of Osiris is not just an ancient artifact story. It's not just a fairy tale, but it has this extraordinary representation of power, doesn't it? And so this idea that it could be buried under a hill in Hollywood, as crazy as it sounds, becomes very interesting. I do not know the original source of the legend. I do have some suspicions that Linda came upon this when she was studying the Emerald Tablets in Colorado, because without going too much into the story, after her death, her copies of the Emerald Tablet translations and her notes were passed on to me. So I am very lucky to have those in my possession. So I have some insight into what she was working on. Plus, I had access to records from her estate after her death, and I was able to spend a year going through some of her material. So again, that was a huge gift for me to be able to do that. But this idea that the 14th piece of Osiris was buried in Hollywood and was the original reason that this space was one of the great pilgrimage sites on Earth is something that Linda was very connected to. Now, a lot of people, including some of our ancient alien friends, were kind of scoffed at it and said, yeah, but, you know, where's the proof and where did it come from? And as I said to them, and I will say to you, I don't have any proof, but here's what I know. Linda believed it with all of her heart. Linda spent a significant amount of money trying to prove it. And Linda took expeditions up to this hill in search of proof. She hired geologists. She hired people with sonar technology. Now, sonar technology in the late 80s, early 90s is certainly not what it is today. So I think it would be really interesting to take that approach today. But here is what I know. She was actively in search of proof that there was a structure, a man-made structure, underneath this hill in Hollywood. And she was certain, beyond a doubt, that she could prove this. And this was one of the things that she told me. Now, shortly after I had this conversation with Linda, she got sick. Linda ended up suffering from diabetes. She was not fantastic at taking care of herself. Her disease went unchecked, and she ultimately went through a terrible period. She went through amputations, and she passed away in October of 1995. I never talked to her again. And it was not until about 1999, I believe, that I was contacted by someone who was working with her estate to come in and do some work and look through some of her archives. What was very, very interesting to me, and I believe I had access to everything, and I talked to so many people in that time period who knew Linda at the end of her life. There are no records anywhere of the work she was doing on this hill. All of her research on the Hollywood Hill disappeared at the time of her death. So that's, of course, frustrating. However, we were able to track down a couple of people who were friends of hers, who were involved peripherally, who were either had gone to the Hill with her and were at least able to confirm, yes, she did have information. Yes, she was working off survey maps. Yes, she did have all kinds of things that she was following up on where she truly believed with all her heart she could prove this. In addition, her theory was that this is why Hollywood is Hollywood, that because there is this extraordinary energy buried in this hill, that that it radiated from this land and that people could feel that there was something very special that happened in this place. And that is why it's become the heartbeat of media that reaches around the world, because there is a message embedded in this particularly very sacred piece of land that matters. And that was her message. And whether you think she was crazy, whether you think I was crazy, I think it's a fantastic message. It is something worth following up on. And I have been working on this since Linda passed away in 1995. And without going too much into detail, I will say this. Every year on December 8th, I go to that hill and I perform a very specific prayer and ceremony in honor of that day, in honor of Linda's belief, and in honor of the reunion of Isis and Osiris.
And yes, I mean, first of all, the magic of Hollywood. Now, there's one missing element, and it is what happens on that New Year's Day, and it happens in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. And it's written down by Linda in her book. And in that, one of the upcoming episodes, I think it's episode 9 or 10 of Ancient Alien Season 2, there's going to be about how alien visitations. We all know about angelic visitations. We know about encounters with people who change their lives, whether they're human, angelic, ET, or whatever. And in Linda Goodman's Star Signs, there is several pages of what has happened in the Hollywood Roosevelt on that New Year's Day. And the story starts off extremely simple. Linda is doing a book tour. She has, done book signings. She's staying in that hotel. And there's a knock on her door early in the morning. And she opens up. And a man stands there. And he says his name is Nathan. Spelled slightly differently. H-T rather than T-H. And he gets in and begins to tell her story. And by the time he leaves, Linda is convinced that she just has had an encounter with what she describes as something of an invisible master, somebody who has come from somewhere extremely far away, has bilocated or teleported himself to her. And he tells her about how she should leave and go to the mountains of Colorado, where she will meet her twin soul. They have encounters about Osiris. Sorry, they have discussions about Osiris and Isis. So there's definitely very clear that there is this twin soul element of the story with her. And then Nathan disappears or leaves. At the end of when she has closed the door on him, there is a very interesting scene where very few words, I think, speak a thousand words. Because at that moment in time, from her room in the Hollywood Roosevelt, she says that she went to sit by the window and she stared into the distance and she could see the Hollywood Cross. She doesn't say anything more. She doesn't say that Nathan has said certain things about that Hollywood Cross. She doesn't say that there's something hidden, that there's a pyramid there. But when you put it into context, you begin to wonder whether certain things she could not commit to paper at the time she was writing it, because she was actively gathering information about it. But when you read that passage with the knowledge you have, Kathleen, when you combine those two together, you come away with the story that Nathan told her something about that hill in 1970, that was a life-changing event. Not simply for what Nathan was, but for what Nathan told her. When he left, she made two life-changing decisions. One, to go and live in Colorado. The second, to start doing research into the Hollywood Hills, and that very much kind of like, you know, preoccupied her together with the quest for Sally, her daughter, and would be all consuming for the rest of her life. And then when she gets to Colorado, there's definitely clear evidence that she contacted local people there who were interested in the Hermetica, into Osiris, into the Emerald Tablets, and all of that material, which would further her understanding of what this was all about.
So why December 8th? This brings us back to why does all this happen on December 8th? It was Linda who told me that December 8th was the feast day of Isis and Osiris, that it represented the healing of Osiris, that December 8th represented the remembering of Osiris. That is when the day that she put him back together, the day that she created the artificial phallus, and in doing so, was able to, with the sympathy of the other gods who helped her, who were so inspired by her love and her devotion, helped to facilitate the miracle, which was her becoming impregnated immaculately, divinely, with the golden child Horus. Now, if you look on the liturgical calendar in Catholicism for December 8th, you will see that December 8th is a celebration of the Immaculate Conception. So, as we have seen so many times in Christianity, we have the important dates on the Christian calendar have these overlays, if not origins, that come from ancient times. Now, certainly, you know, the ancient Egyptians did not work on the same calendar that we have, and you know, how this all sort of boiled down to being December 8th is not something that I have the answer to. And, you know, and I'm happy to say that. Often people say, well, what about this and why this? And I'll tell you that, you know, there are certain things I have investigated for a long time and have not been able to come up with definitively, i.e., how December 8th and when December 8th officially became known for these things. But I will tell you that that's what I was told. That's the way that Linda viewed it, certainly. And as a result, she entrusted this idea for me to spend December 8th in Hollywood on this hill for some period of time, celebrating the remembering of Osiris and praying for this 14th piece to come forward. And I do every year, and I never miss.
Absolutely. And obviously, when you first told me this story, something else immediately jumped to my mind, because when we're talking about Osiris and the magical birth of Horus, what we're talking about is magical water, which basically is what semen is, and which was kind of like the missing ingredient, if you want, in all of this. Roughly around the time when you were talking about this, I had gone to Arizona, and I had been studying the Hopi legends. And the Hopi legends are extremely interesting. And the Hopi legend which came to mind was this: the Hopi mesas, their dwellings, are quite often in regions which are extremely arid. And archaeologists say, why did they do this here? There must be some sort of water supply which got lost in our archaeological records, because there's no way that thousands of people, hundreds of people, even tens of people could live here for any period of time. Well, Frank Wolters, who is a very controversial person in archaeological circles because he doesn't follow the way it's supposed to go, in the Book of the Hopi, relates to Hopi legends. And one of them is that the Hopis kind of mock the archaeologists, and they say, well, yeah, these were extremely arid regions where we lived in, but what we had a magical water jar. And the gods had given us the magical water jar, and basically what was happening was that every tribe had at least one, sometimes two. We put down the magical water jar somewhere, and wherever it was put down, a river or a spring came out of it. And then when we moved on, we took the magical water jar with us. And so for them, this is their explanation of to what has happened. But the story of the magical water jar is also that it contains the fact that this is made from clay, and clay sometimes broke. So every tribe was told, if your water jar breaks, do not panic, send one person to the extreme west, of your continent, from Arizona, basically, and go to the River Dare, and there you will be able to create a new magical water jar, which you then need to bring with you back to your tribe. Now, for people who've traveled in America, they will know that if you go basically west from the Hopi reservations, you end up in California, and roughly the area, you know, between San Francisco, let's say, and here, Los Angeles, is a very sacred area. It's been populated by Indians, and they have very sacred places here, along the Pacific. So it's not just that they would, if they were to make this journey, would have arrived in an area where there was nobody. They would have come across fellow human beings who might have had some kind of shared patrimony, some shared ancestry with the Hopis. Now, the story of the magical water jar is interesting to do with Osiris, because Osiris is specifically linked with this. He is linked with the magical basket. He has all of the same attributes. He's linked with water, and ancient Egypt, he's Hapi. You know, together as Osiris and Hapi, he becomes Serapis, which is once again with him. Serapis is linked with Canopus. Canopus is the magical water jar by default. It is, you know, ancient Egypt kind of like was so impressed with it. Canopus is one of the places where the Emerald Tablets were kept. Canopus was a suburb of Alexandria. Canopus in the south of ancient Egypt is actually the place. Canopus is an island in the south. There were two Canopuses. One of them was on the north side of the Nile, and one of them was on the extreme south side. And on the south side of the Nile, on the island of Canopus, it was said that the Nile actually originated. It came out of nowhere. Literally, so to speak, like the magic of the water jar in all the places where the Hopis lived. So in a very short space of time, what I'm trying to say is that there are extremely close parallels between the story of Osiris in ancient Egypt and how he was seen as a water deity, and the entire water aspects of the Hopi Indians, and how specifically the Hopis do not say, hey, this magical water jar is somehow made on the Hopi mesas in the very heartland of the Hopis, but actually that they say, it's nowhere near here. You have to go to the west, where somehow we are able to create, by magic, another water jar. And, well, that could be the Hollywood Hill.
Could be. Also, in terms of the water representations, we have Isis, who is Our Lady of the Nile. So she also has these interesting water representations. And as I'm having this discussion with you and with our audience, I am looking at a particularly beautiful Peruvian painting that is on our wall of Mary Magdalene. And Mary Magdalene is holding in her hands her ointment jar, as she most often is. But I have always seen these connections too. Particularly in France, you see there are some extraordinary paintings of Mary Magdalene administering to Jesus in the tomb following the crucifixion, where she is really working to heal him. It's very Isis-like what she is doing. It is very much the preservation of the body of the beloved. So there are certainly these overlays of Mary Magdalene playing the Isis role to Jesus, who is the Osiris in this way. And I've always thought that that was extremely beautiful, because it's about devotion. It's about love. You know, it's about all of those things. So is the 14th piece of Osiris buried under the Hollywood Hill? Who knows? I will tell you that I have definite interests in pursuing the subject. Haven't had the opportunity to really get as involved with it yet as I would like to. But I think it's time to start stirring up some interest and getting some surveys done and start paying attention to what Linda was looking at and see if we can at least get some people interested in the idea that there appears to be something happening in that land.
Absolutely. And one of the things is definitely, then we're talking about a pyramid. people constantly think that what we're talking about is an exact replica of the Great Pyramid in size. So first of all, what we're looking at is not a gigantic hill. It's a sizable hill, but it's not gigantic. First of all, pyramids come in various, not various shapes, but definitely various sizes and various types of construction. So, you know, we're not saying, and I think Linda wasn't saying, that we are looking at a complete stone structure, but somehow that all the surveys, what they had come back with, was that there was a structure inside, which was distinguished from the normal kind of cone shape, or kind of like roughly kind of natural looking shape. And it doesn't, the hill has an interesting shape as such. It doesn't look natural and it doesn't look artificial, if that makes sense. It looks very eroded, and obviously the fact that it sits next to a freeway, that it sits in the middle of Hollywood, that parts of it has been used as a building site for houses, doesn't really help. You know, man has had its way with this hill, as is visible by the fact that there's a gigantic cross sitting on its top and a theater on the side.
An extremely valuable property also on the hill. That's the other that's the other issue. You know, this is the Hollywood Hills. The houses there are very, very valuable.
So we're not just looking at when we're looking on one side to a painting of Mary Magdalene. On the other side, we have Mission Peak out of our window, and that is very much largely untouched, apart from some trails leading up to the top. But that's another story. But what we have in the Hollywood Hills is something basically which looks interesting, but basically all the hard archaeological and technological material which Linda has thrown at suggested or showed that there was something in it, including, I believe, an anomaly, as in like a cavity or some kind of structure which is still smaller than the pyramid structure itself, which is underneath, if this makes sense.
Yeah, in conclusion, I really want to say about this show that one of the things that I love about this story, and it has inspired me for, you know, a large portion of my life, is that Isis and Osiris were essentially the first spirit revolutionaries. And Linda Goodman was one of the great modern spiritual revolutionaries. Linda Goodman was fearless, and that's what I want to celebrate here as we come to the end of the show. She was an extraordinary character. She was absolutely fearless about speaking out and the things that she believed in. She didn't care who believed her, who did not. She did not care if anyone was going to ridicule her and say that something was outlandish. She was truly one of the great pioneering inspirational thinkers of our time. And she was a huge influence on me. And I was blessed, even in those hours that I was on the phone with her, to have known her even for that period of time, and certainly to have been around her work. So the vow that I renew, in addition to everything else I do on December 8th, to Linda, is that I will continue to talk about this story as long as there is breath in my body, and keep it out there and keep it alive, and certainly talk about the legend of Isis and Osiris, the idea of twin souls, which she was incredibly committed to. She called them twin selves, and not twin souls, but the idea is the same. And she was also the first person who whispered some secrets about Mary Magdalene into my ear long before I was anywhere near ready to listen to them. So this one was for you, Linda, where you are in your place at the right or left arm of our mother and father in heaven.
And if you're out and about tomorrow, well, think about that Immaculate Conception. Think about the healing and love of Isis and Osiris, and specifically the, I think, the widow aspect is something which they were trying to do as well within that sense of the ancient Egyptians. So that is if you're out and about tomorrow. However, if you're out and about in the Denver area on Saturday, Kathleen and I are organizing a seminar there called The Writer's Grail. And if you go to thewritersgrail.com, you will find information there. It is a seminar about writing. And it's a day-long seminar in the Courtyard Marriott Hotel, Cherry Creek. So if you have time and you are in the area, or you can get to that area on December 11th, that's precisely where we will be, and we hope to see you there as well. If you have time, also check out our archives. Our archives are on the bbsradio.com website. We are on iTunes. We are also on thespiritrevolution.com, and most of our shows are available there. They are completely available on the BBS archives for a small fee. They are roughly available for its entirety on iTunes, and the last five shows are always available on the show overview page on thespiritrevolution.com.
And they are free. They are free on iTunes, everyone. So yes, if you are an aspiring writer, we are really doing an inspirational seminar in Denver this weekend for those of you who want to make 2011 your writing year. I'm really, really excited about that. There are a few things I love talking about as much as writing. But until then, my friends, the truth against the world, no matter how outlandish it may be.